Hurra, hurra! Ein Design-Podcast der Burg. Hi and welcome to a new episode of the Hurra Hurra podcast. This is in English language, as you hear, and this time we have Roger Robinson as a guest. And Roger is not a designer, he's a poet, and mostly known for his books, A Portable Paradise and A Home is Not a Place, plus many other things we will talk about in this podcast. I came across his works because he was the singer of King Midas Sound, which is a music band, I would say, of The Buck, aka Kevin Richard Martin and Roger Robinson, before also with Kiki Hitomi. And Roger did bring me to a deeper understanding of what poetry is and could be, also in English language. And I'm a big fan, to be honest. And his two books, for me mostly A Portable Paradise, is such a great recommendation to everybody who wants to dive into UK poetry, black culture. It's simply great. We will have a lot of stuff of this in the show notes. Also two DJ mixes from King Midas Sound where you can hear Roger reciting poems. So enjoy that. And now we start and go into the interview talk with Roger Robinson. So enjoy. Roger, to start with our conversation, I want to kindly ask you if you could introduce yourself in your own words. Who are you, to bring the audience a bit on track?
My name is Roger Robinson. I'm a poet, musician, general all-around community dude. Always thinking about how art, writing can make people's lives better. I'm neurodiverse, and sometimes I have the idea that I've got into art in the way I have, or got into poetry more specifically, to see the world with a clearer lens because of my neurodiversity.
As neurodiversity is a spectrum, mm-hmm. Can you tell what kind of color?
Dyslexic, slightly ADHD, slightly autistic, but more dyslexia. Yeah.
You're a poet.
Yeah.
With this dyslexia?
Yeah, for real.
Okay.
Yeah. It's interesting, but far more common than you think. A lot of the poets I actually know, especially the ones from my community, are dyslexic in some way, on the spectrum in some way. There's something about the portability of poetry that kind of links with dyslexia. And dyslexia, you have a lot of lateral thought, and you have what I call four-dimensionality, or people see it different ways, where you can attack certain things from many different angles. So in a way, it's a kind of superpower for poetry. But if you ever saw me read a novel, it would take a very, very long time. So, you know, poetry is for the people who love reading and dyslexic, because you can handle all the amount of text, you know, at a time, and you can really take it in. But you also notice patterns. So mm-hmm. neurodiverse people are pattern recognizers. And poetry often works on pattern recognition, and music to some extent too. Yeah.
And you say you're an overall community dude. Can you just tell a bit more specific what that means?
Well, I say it specifically, but in detail is probably not more that much more specific. I believe in this idea called creative citizenship. And creative citizenship is kind of building a world that you want to see and debunking, you know, old and stale ideas of who belongs and who doesn't belong. And but on another level, I actually find that not involving community in what you do, whether it be writers, people, family, friends, it just makes life a lot more boring. You know, it's like the fun of making art for me is all the journeys I make with the people who I have around me, the different conversations about making books. And I take part, I say I'm a community dude because I take part in other people's conversations about the art they're making. I also invite them to have conversations about art making. And, you know, we also do some, not necessarily charitable things, but I would say creative citizenship things. I run this something called Rest Retreat for Black writers specifically, where they can go into Wales, into the forest, into a cottage, and just spend a couple of days there to rest. The idea is not, it's not about producing anything. It's not about, it's like, it's based on Trisha Hissey's idea of rest as resistance. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there's an uncommon amount of strain on Black writers. So with the Rest Retreat, the idea is to kind of combat that sense of your creativity has to be a source of capitalism all the time, and just to get some rest. Yeah.
That's interesting. Because I have a few questions going mm-hmm. in that direction. Prepared. Prepared is a big word. And I want to follow that line of a community person, because next to the books, and I only have The Portable Paradise mm-hmm. and The Home Is Not a Place.
Yes.
I really, really, really like them, especially a Portable Paradise. Every time I talk about it to everybody,
yeah.
I really get emotional because it is... I know you, I know is a big word, but from the King Midas sound stuff, from the stuff that you do with Disrupt, and especially the King Midas sound fact mix where your poem is in the beginning.
Right.
And then I just somehow got into that. Yeah. And there is this major part in this book to me is that where the whole Greenfell Tower disaster is handled.
Yeah.
And and from a German perspective, it was all over the news and stuff and social media. But here, it was the first time that I saw it from the perspective of the people who live there, who are affected the mostly and the most saddest way on this. It's a great book. It's in the show notes for everybody listening. It's,
you know, part of it was, you know, in seeing the news and stuff, like in that particular section, it wasn't seeing the damage to the spirit of the people who live there, but also the damage to the spirit of all, you know, global majority people who lived in England. You know what I'm saying? It's like how much suffering there actually was. So if the book was a success in any way, it did capture that for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I'm glad to hear that it
captured it for other people too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So next to your I would just say body of work in the field of poetry, you also have these two textbooks on your website on creativity and on poetry. Yeah. There was also one on form, which brought me to the dialogue here. But Nicola, your assistant, told me that that you took it off.
We have to do some updates there, you know, because in on form there was a lot more people working in creating their own form.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, I need to get that in, because that's an important movement to where form is going. And so I was like, you know what, let me put it down and see if I could even talk and interview some people who created their own form and what was the impetus behind it, how they created it and stuff like that. So I think it was important enough for me to take it down and just like, you get that in, you know.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So when this podcast is online, I'm sure it will be, we put it in the show notes as soon as it's it's released. Sure.
And that's the thing about digital publishing, right? You can alter it as you go, you know? Like, I learned from, like, I don't know if you know Kanye West, The Life of Pablo. When he was putting up The Life of Pablo, he was, like, literally changing it every week. I was like, whoa, what? You can just add more to a product, you know what I'm saying, and take it down. So that's, I actually find it that, you know, one of the things I have is that whatever form I'm working in, sometimes I try to see what is the limits of the form and where the form can kind of move to. So even within digital publishing, I actually quite like the idea I could take it down, make changes, and put it back up again, you know? And so it could be a kind of moving an organic thing, because it's not, you can get with the idea that it's a fixed thing, like a print and paper and a book. Yeah. Because if you had to change print and paper, you would literally have to go through thousands and thousands of pounds. Yeah. And then, you know, probably not have a recall, but say new edition and, you know, relaunch. There's so much to do. With a digital book, you can literally take it down, change the words, and then put it back up again, you know. And then because you're a record of everybody who bought it, you can send them the version, whether they want to open it or not. That's really up to them. You can send it to them for free. There's no cost.
Yes, and that's why I choose this podcast format, because right. It's basically the same, and I don't have to write things down, and you can just kind of like bubble it up. And if I see, oh shit, that was a bit too far out, I just can't change it, and it's no, there's no effect. Yeah. So still, two of them are online, Poetry and Form, and I see these as teaching utilities in a way.
Yeah, sure.
And this is a podcast usually on design education. And right. I really like the fact that on creativity, for example, are just short reminders and tasks. I see these, I wrote it down because I forgot how it's called. From Brian Eno, use oblique strategies, it was called. Yeah. It was like a set of cards.
And yeah.
And in the on poetry, I felt a bit as a layperson, because I use poetry as a criteria in the design process, and not as a tool to a thing, and not as an art form itself. Is it okay to do so in a way? Because as you, as a poet, just asking. So
Is it okay? I'm trying to understand the question. So you use poetry as a kind of aesthetic for design, or poetry as an addition, like a textual addition to design?
No, rarely as an addition. Mostly as something that how it is perceived. Because in a way, poetry has a flow. Poetry has a sound. It's in the lack of the right words to describe things, or to get into a complexity that no one can follow, because it's a complex process of creating things. Yeah. Poetry helps to get it to the people, and it's a very tool-y approach. And reading your poems is maybe poetry isn't the right term for that.
I mean, I use whatever thing that you get to get any message to any people, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you use poetry, that's great. And if it can magnify, I think what poetry can do is really magnify emotions. So, you know, sometimes when things, and poetry also has a certain type of efficiency. So when it comes to design, if you could magnify emotions and be efficient, then all of a sudden in your design, you have something that's poetic, you know?
Because somehow I feel there's a contrast in between emotions and efficiency.
There's a contrast?
To me, yes.
It's not a juxtaposed contrast. It's something that could work efficiently in terms of its orchestration. Yes, how you orchestrate it. So, if you're trying to get over emotions, sometimes efficiency gets it across in a cleaner sense. Yes, in a more streamlined, cleaner sense, and the emotions can become magnified because there's nothing to interfere with it. So someone like Dieter Rams, like Dieter Rams, the clean lines of his design got over to me emotions in a poetic way. It was efficient and poetic, you know. It kind of less is more sense. And that's why it's been copied from everyone, from iPhone to Samsung to what you call it, because you need that type of poetry. And to some extent, that efficiency in your life, because as life continues on, there's a lot of clutter. And for something to be seen, What you need to do is reduce clutter. And you could take that principle to anything. If you have the design elements of a house and it's full of stuff, you're not going to see the design elements. So the efficiency will enhance the design of a house. If you,
First, strong display of knowledge on design history from your side.
I'm just an internet nerd, man.
And on the other hand, that made it clear to me, because that's why I think poetry is good, or is the right term for it. Because if I use story or narrative, too many words, too many characters, plot lines, stuff, super complex and no direct message, feedback and stuff. So that's...
I was thinking about poetry. Poetry is the right words in the right order. And a similar thing with design. Design is the right elements in the right combination. You know, it's like... So there's similarities between the two.
Yes. And that leads me to the next kind of question, is that... it's also in your poetry book that that you really make the difference between spoken words and written words, and you also use there's an example that you say that you use is like the built-in Mac speech synth like fake speech generator in to test the written words, how do they sound, and where syntax is missing. Yeah. And I really ask you as a poet, how do you work with these words? Do you work with them as speech, or do you work with them as letters? So in as a designer, I'm very formal. I have materials, I have users, I have all the other stuff. But as a poet, there's not just, but there's mostly these words in their minimum two ways of existence. Yeah. How do you go to that?
I mean, I think both. I think to some extent, I'm originally from Trinidad. That's where I was raised. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very oral culture. So I always have been thinking, you know, especially with music and lyrics and stuff like that, how words sound, you know? But I think in my not so much progress, in my experience as a writer, is like how the formal elements kind of cohere on the page, but then I always come back to sound. I always come back to, like, it might cohere on the page, but it still has to sound well. I don't know if I have this in the book. In the first poetry book I wrote, to some extent, I was so involved in the sound that no one else could read it. Yeah, so I wrote it with a Trinidadian accent and didn't know, because I only had the sound of my head. Yes, and so Trinidadian people could read it beautifully because I wrote it for their sound. But everybody else from every other culture couldn't understand the sound from the words on the page. And then I learned something about the function of the words on the page, that it has to act like a musical score for musicians. And a musical score has to work with every musician. So if the musical score has four hands playing the piano, then that's not going to work, because that's not for an actual musician. Yes? Because a musician does not have four hands. And so the idea is that you create something that can be read by anyone from any culture, because the way it's written, with its stresses and unstresses and all the formal elements, will allow it to be read by anybody, regardless of their culture.
And do you have a strong kind of veto right or something when it comes to the graphical or visual representation of your text? So kind of what font, what size, and stuff. So is it cursive, or is it italic, or is it bold written?
Right.
Do you work with that?
Well, these days I'm really into E.B. Garamond, you know. is it old school? Is E.B. Garamond kind of old school? I'm not sure if it's old school or new school, you know.
It's a classic.
It's a classic. Yeah, so I'm very into type fonts at the moment, especially with my stuff and new stuff I'm doing. But before, in the early books, in A Portable Paradise, I don't know what it was in this. I don't know what font we use in the back. I think I put the font in the back of it. Do I say what the font is in the back?
It says about the author. It does not tell the font.
It doesn't say the font.
Nope, it's not.
I can't remember. I remember saying that I wanted a particular font, which they weren't using at the time.
But it's to the listeners. It's with serifs. It looks like a Bodoni font, I would say.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
A non-linear antiqua font. That's the
yes,
right
yeah, yeah,
word.
Yeah, yeah, that's
sorry.
Pretty, that's pretty, yeah. Yeah, and so definitely, I think about readability. I think about how how bright the pages, because in yes. the books I like, they don't have that modern bright whiteness of poor quality paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I quite like the idea that the paper is not secondhand, recycled.
Mm-hmm.
That recycled paper, because of its hue and because of its texture, it has a sense of rest. So a space in between the stanzas, you have a sense of rest. And so even with A Portable Paradise, there's a sense that it's so overwhelming with sadness at some points.
Yes,
that
it is.
That there's something that you have to be able to have the eye rest to some extent. And that is about the grayness of the paper that I thought about. And also in the cover, so I don't know if you know, the cover is actually Johnny Pitts, who
edited
the other book.
Yes, I know. It's the guy who did the Afropian book.
Yes,
I only
yes,
have it
yeah,
in
Johnny
the German
Pitts,
version.
Right.
Yeah.
Afropaish. Yeah, so it's just like, so the cover is Johnny Pitts, and I wanted to have a picture on the front where they had young black men. They're not playing sports. They're not being angry. They're in a neutral, quiet position, just waiting around, so that you couldn't say that this will fall into any particular stereotypes of behavior. And so I wanted elements of quiet, but elements of black, sometimes Europeanness, but black culture in a particular way, you know?
Yeah, and talking about fonts, that this kind of font has the advantage that it's irregular, so the vertical strokes have a different width than the diagonal. Ones.
Wow, that's
so,
wild.
And that leads to the fact that you have more white, as you say, more white space
exactly.
in the line
exactly.
itself, in difference
exactly.
to
yeah,
the
yeah.
one in Home is Not a Place, where it is, I think it's Accidents Grotesque. Font.
A former Helvetica in a way, yeah.
Yeah, and it's much more strong lined.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So and it's a much bolder message you bring.
Well, I think the design decision for that is that some of the pictures were so moody and smudged
mm-hmm.
that we needed something cleaner to juxtapose, you know, so that the poems could hold its own. The interesting thing mm-hmm. about Home is Not a Place is that when the book got signed to Fourth Estate, they actually bought in the designer before we started the book. So the designer was like the fifth Beatle in the
mm-hmm.
entire thing. So we sent him things from the very first things we wrote. And we were sending him textures, we were sending him poems, and he was coming into meetings as if he was one of the writers.
Oh, really?
How
does that feel?
It was amazing. It was amazing because we got along really well with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he understood the politics of what we're talking about. So we had lots of meetings with him as we were going on. You know, so if you see like lots of little pieces, lots of that book where they have like lots of pieces of smudge mm-hmm. on the edge of pages. Pages look like they were not burnt, but you know, like they were part of the printing stuff. Those were things he suggested probably in the first week of us trying to make the book. You
yeah.
know, And it was easy to say to him no, and it was easy for him to describe to him, to describe to us what it was, and he understood our aesthetic perfectly. We were like really, really happy with the design because he was a part of the team. And so much so, like if I go to, he's from Newcastle. Mm-hmm. No, he's from Sheffield. If I go to Sheffield, I'll ring him up and we just go and have coffee and stuff. Even to this day, we still type. In fact, there's another book I was going to do called 500 Reminders for Artists. And he did the cover for that too, but the book didn't materialize as yet.
Yeah. The book, Home is Not a Place, I don't know if I understood it right, but it's together with Johnny Pitts, you wrote along the coastal line of Britain, right?
Yeah. Okay. Where anti-clock rides are on the coast of Britain.
Yeah. And because you said that for A Portable Paradise, you choose a picture of a young black man, non-stereotype.
Yeah.
Which is not difficult, but it's the point that you have one picture and you have to nail it down. In Home is Not a Place, you have, like, I don't know how many pages. There are no page numbers, but like a lot of pages.
Yeah.
To paint a much more broader picture of what black culture is at along the coastline or wherever these pictures are from. And that worked really well. I just can say it's a pleasure to have this book as a credit to your designer and Johnny Pitts as a photographer and you with the text. It matches really, oh,
thank
really,
you
really
very
well
much,
on that.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that book. And this is one of those projects that even if they didn't pay us any money to do it, we would have probably still done it. You know, it's like a personal passion project, you know. Yeah. And in that book, we definitely had a sense of what for black culture is the banal and normal. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the banal in terms of, you know, Johnny always says this best, is like, so black people are always either sportsmen or kings or overachievers. Mm-hmm. They always have to be something extra. But what they never are portrayed is just like humanized. And in the banal, there was something mm-hmm. human. And if they consider you as human, there was also a lot of stuff that this was after, there was a weird space after George Floyd. And we were saying that like, if it is that, you know, we were to take black people in their banality as human, then perhaps killing them won't be so easy because you're dealing mm-hmm. with a humanity, not just a trope or a stereotype, you know?
Yeah. In your book on poetry, you have the prompt, which is quite interesting because in my daily work or the word prompt came to my everyday life due to artificial intelligence and text-based generation of text.
Yeah, like a prompt pilot.
Yeah, and now,
like prompt pilots, you know, like your prompts is for AI.
Yeah. So that's I write something down, a prompt, and then it generates me an image and all that stuff. So and the prompts you use are mostly like small exercises to ease your flow or to sharpen certain aspects in your craft. But I want to ask you as a professional text person or word person, do you work with artificial intelligence in a creative process? And did you try your prompts also with these machine tools?
I haven't, because this was before I started. Those two books are before I started interacting with AI at all. Mm-hmm. And so I've started interacting with AI. I think it's interesting and it's pretty inevitable. But I'm trying to find what I don't want it to do is to think for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Because that's my role. I'm the artist. I don't want it to think for me, you know? But I think there's something interesting in it when you bring, say, for example, neurodiverse, yeah? So when I bring a whole idea written in text and I correct for grammar, which I'm not super strong at, that's when it's interesting for me. But then when I correct for grammar, if it starts to write for me, because all I really want is grammar corrections. I don't want it to write for me. Yeah. And so it's very helpful for me in terms of grammar and things like Grammarly and stuff like that, picking up on little bits that could change and a colon instead of a semicolon, you know. I think that's interesting. I think in writing it's a really interesting thing. I'm not anti-AI. I don't have, you know, lots of people have things against AI. I think it can work really well when you could bring your own artistic intelligence to AI as opposed to letting AI be the artistic intelligence.
Yeah, I see that in the same way. What I saw is, I'm very strong in ideas, yes, but I lack the consistency of working things out properly.
So you finish.
So there, I once had an idea on a larger text, but I had just a few raw imaginations on it, and I tried. That was the first time I tried ChatGPT, and I said, "Hey, I want this text with these kind of persons," and I describe more or less what's in my head. Give me, let's say, 3 pages of text for that.
What's the text for? Is it creative text or is it for like copy editing or is it?
No, it was just a creative text. I had the weird idea of setting or let the whole plot of the movie Dune play in the rural East Germany. And then it went.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, but the idea was from me. That's what.
Yeah, I know. But it's just like it's a great idea to put into AI and see what's been solved.
It was great, and then it gave me just more, let's call it meat to work on. Sure. So okay.
Yeah, they give you a spine for
deal. And then I can just go more into details, derail wherever I think it's starting. And okay, it's not a blank page anymore. I have something that I can. Throw away or work further on. So that's something I really like, and it's also something that when we go over to your book on or to the ebook on creativity, it's a lot on this situations of the blank page of not getting into work, procrastination and all that stuff. I really, really saw that, and I thought, "Oh yeah, I know that." and still, I felt that it is very personal and from your biography. So, do you struggle with that a lot usually? So these are like coping mechanisms to go over it.
I think I think a lot of the book has come from what keeps me going. So in my university, one of the things I'm really good at is kind of working out systems to keep it moving, you know, because I have that active mind. And so I just like, okay, what else do I need to keep it moving? Especially the idea that you don't have to judge it. You just have to keep it moving. So in my career, I've been writing seriously for 30 years and literally with no encouragement whatsoever. So I had to find ways to kind of keep it moving. So I think on creativity is like a kind of list of all my ways I've kept it moving, you know, for those 6 years.
Still, you in the beginning you said there's this restless resistance and there is this I imagine it as a house in the forest of Wales where writers do not be active,
active. You tell them not to be active, but they always write anyway. But there's no requirement for them to write anything. You know, it's yeah.
Yes, but there is in that On Creativity book so much on understanding for not being creative in moments.
Yes.
So like, patting my shoulder and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. It will come back. Just
breathe
in, breathe out. go to the next page and then let's go. Which is very relaxing and also empowering. Ah, okay, whew, I can start over from my inner self and not from an external push to be creative. Yeah. But still, it has a lot of times that I don't know what I wrote. I think I wrote down this kind of coach on the sideline screaming at you, be creative, be creative. So it has this like a kind of imperative of being creative all the time. But it has this, sometimes it tends to flip over to this
very pushy thing. What you're doing is just like a kick in the butt to some extent. Yeah, there's a tension between those two things, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and I guess you're right. Because a lot of the things actually come from certain points and times that certain systems are made. So sometimes they probably have some contradictions. Mm-hmm. But like, I think people will take from it whatever they need. So if they need that push, they'll take the push. If they need the rest, they'll take the rest. You know? So I don't mind the contradictions in that. In terms of the tone, really. It's really about a tone.
Yeah. And visual representation, because also here the font work is quite bold. It's very in your face.
Yeah.
Things are statements and closed loops. So every page, sometimes it goes over. So it gives that relation.
I think the original things came from like the idea of aphorisms.
Mm-hmm.
Aphorisms have a kind of slightly terse. I used to do this on Twitter. So these things I used to write on Twitter more or less daily, you know? Mm-hmm. So the book is more like a compilation as opposed to like me sitting on writing a book from beginning to end. So, you know, they'll have some elements. I didn't design it. But it's like, it was really interesting when it's presented for me. It's just like how different the process of design is for online media as opposed to a book. You know, online media, it seems to me, just has a lot more graphic orientation to it, as opposed to letting the text of a book just sit by itself and be, you know. Like, you have to raise it out from the computer a little bit, it seems, you know. And also, I didn't want it to be too much, so I wanted a kind of unified feel. So, you know, my critique, but my addition was just like, it has to be unified. You just can't have one part standing out, because it's not a poster. It's part of a bigger whole, you know, even though it's small bits.
Yeah, even small bits. That's the advantage of aphorisms. They work really well on posters.
Yeah.
And there's one. Let's call it the aphorism or one prompt or one thing where you differentiate between reach and depth. And I think that goes into that social media thing.
Right.
And that made me think, for example, I was like, it's true. We strive for depth in everything we do. We really want to dig in and be good in things really well. But to bring it out, we have to have that reach. And I think that's also kind of contradictionary, in a, not in a bad manner, but in a way of, there is something, there's friction in that in between that. And I think you manage quite well to be like around on the portable screens, but also in, I mean, this book is deep in a very very true. Very
you know what helped me with that, there's a while back I read this writer called Cal Newport. Have you heard of Cal Newport? So Cal Newport talks about the idea of deep work.
I know deep work.
You need deep work. Okay, so deep work is the book. That's Cal Newport is a writer. And it kind of goes against everything on the internet, you know? That deep work, and that the people who make long-lasting work that lasts past their death and stuff like that, they're not interrupted by things like social media, because the neurons of their brain, they can go deeply into a work. And the work can start to expose, start to reveal secrets that people who are not doing deep work will not be able to find. And that deep work can't work with social media interruptions, even in terms of content making and stuff like that. So I thought it was like a very interesting idea. Definitely A Portable Paradise came out of deep work, and to some extent, Home Is Not a Place came out of deep work. It's like managing Home Is Not a Place, I barely looked at the internet, you know? Like I might set up a few things, on Hootsuite to kind of be posted, but you know, most of the time you were just in it, you know, in conversations, traveling, in where you could. It was like, it was done offline. And then one of the things he contends in deep work is that, you know, if the work's good enough, people will make social media things about you. People will do the social media for you because the work is so good, because you go so deep and you make such a contribution to society. And it still resonates with me now. I'm like writing a novel at the moment. And I'm like, I was like, you know, like my, like even the form book was the last thing where I was just like, because I had a lot of information. I was posting a lot. I was like, you know, I have to stop this and really get back into some deep work for this, you know, because it doesn't make a difference. They got people with a million followers who don't buy anything from anyone. they got a million followers and they can't sell 1,000 books because the work isn't deep. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, they just know how to catch the eye of somebody who spends 1 second and give them something that they ultimately forget. And that there's no, that's not a critique. It's just not what I'm doing, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, and honestly, sometimes I mess these books up because I read them like simultaneously. But there is this one that where you say that try not to please the 90% with the mediocre art, but try to catch these 10 ones that really dig it and bring you further. That is, that's a good prompt.
Yeah. I think I was reading a lot of, have you heard of Kevin Kelly?
Yep. First things first.
Yeah. Kevin Kelly had this idea of 1,000 true fans that was really helpful to my career. So he was just like, if you have 1,000 true fans who will buy everything you do during the course of the year, you don't need a million followers. Mm-hmm. So if you present to your 1,000 true fans who buy everything from you, £100 worth of work per year, and you really communicate with those fans, you talk to them, you give them a value, and they buy stuff from you, you can have £100,000 a year and live comfortably as an artist. And that's very much, I come from that type of perspective in terms of making work. I just don't wait for people to hire me. I'm trying to talk to those true fans. And those true fans, they kind of come and go. But if you have 1,000 true fans every year, I'm also working with, you know, in King Madison with Kevin and the Bug and stuff like that. You know, that's the kind of basis like you see these people live on. You know, they make a living, but they don't make a living making work for everybody. You know what I'm saying? They make a work because they that 10%. King Madison, it's like, I think I know more people who don't like King Madison than like King Madison. But then the people who like it are rabid about it. Like even monthly, people say, is there going to be a new King Madison album or not? Is this project done? I want to know. You know what I'm saying? I was like, it's not done, but we're going to get to another one at some point, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I really had to think about that because like Kevin, aka The Bug, is one. I have a few records, but the most of them are from Kevin. Bought everything.
So you're a true fan of Kevin, you know what I'm
saying? Yeah, and it's a, and I think it has something to do with the display of passion and expertise and craft.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I like the word. I think I want to say uncompromised. Like there is uncompromised.
If you look up uncompromising in the dictionary, you'll probably see Kevin's face. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But Kevin's a musical genius too. Like I'm one of the few people who got to spend a lot of time with him. You know, because we toured, we traveled, and you know what I'm saying? But Kevin's a genius, dude. It's like, I was really lucky. Like, when he wanted to work with me, I was just like, what? For real? You know? But just to spend time with him, I learned most of the things I know about music from Kevin. You know, me and Kevin worked together for probably 15 years, you know, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Talking about learning, let's talk about teaching.
Yeah.
you offer workshops, you do, you share your knowledge. Did you learn how to share your knowledge? Because just a reflection on what this podcast is about. We started this because as designers, we learn how to design from people
right.
who know how to design but do not know how to teach. So it's something really weird.
Yeah.
It's like an infinite loop of unreflectiveness in a way.
Yeah.
And I, as a practicing designer, I came into teaching
yes.
with no clue of what I'm doing.
And, yeah.
and there is no discourse on that because
yeah.
everybody is not knowing what they are doing and nobody sure. is going to admit it. So I said, yeah. okay, let's make this up and think, okay, let's share this. Let's get into this discussion. And I think,
right.
and I assume or I, yeah, I think that it's the same way with you, that you just do it the way you do it. And is
yeah.
it like that?
I just try to devise systems. Also, because I'm neurodiverse, I understand things in a particular way. And so everything I teach is a system. Yeah. So if I'm teaching poetry, I'm teaching how I would want to learn it. So I'm getting people to draw things, to juxtapose things, to think about context. Then they label it in terms of imagery. Then they, so if I'm doing workshop with, you know, teenagers or kids, then they label things, then they'll hear things. So I'm trying to get the hearing, sight, get all the senses involved. And then I start to think what shapes and form, what shapes and stuff do. So I go, all my teaching is a series of little bits that mm-hmm. make a whole that I know. And so then you throw questioning to make them think, so they start to get kind of critical thoughts. So everything is just really tiny bits to get a concept, but all the concepts linked together as a song, yes? And by the end of the song, they should really understand a lot about themselves and what they can do, yeah? A lot about what I'm saying. And then, you know, and then get them with the idea of if they practiced more, that this song would be easier for them to sing, you know? So.
And sounds like a good plan. but
yeah.
How do you work with, I mean, do you interact with other teachers? Do you exchange that knowledge? Do you craft it in a way? Or is it just like, okay, that worked fine, this less. Next time I'm just going to do this. Because I don't want to overemphasize it, but as educators, I don't like the word teacher in a way, or as a,
yeah.
as enablers of experience spaces, whatever that means. But mm-hmm. it's, we have a kind of a responsibility because people give us their time, and it's we as one person give time, but there are so many others giving their time too.
Right.
There's an imbalance in that. Talking about effectiveness, sometimes mm-hmm. there should be an impact that honestly can be measured in a way. Mm-hmm. But is there a dialogue, or do you have kind of a critical friends working with you on getting better in that?
Yes, over the years. But, you know, so in it, there's a certain level of adaptation. So you mm-hmm. have to read the room like a performer. Yeah, you have to see, okay, where's the energy? Where are people going with things? Where are you disconnecting with people, you know? And how can you bring them back in again? Where do you put your concentration on? You know, just like in a crowd when you're performing, they have segments of your audience who are not taking you on, and they have segments giving you all the energy. And so sometimes you think, okay, let me only give the energy mm-hmm. to the people who are giving me energy. No, but sometimes you have to actually go to the people who are not giving you any energy and concentrate on them and create this energy in the room. So in terms of teaching, there's an element of performance and reading and understanding the room. You know, that's important too. Here again, neurodiversity helps. Because if I ask a child or even an adult if they understand something and they tell me yes, I can tell it's no from their body language. Because neurodiverse people can, they have that thing where they read micro things, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'll be like, okay, let me explain it again, because I know they're just saying yes because they feel embarrassed that they don't understand, you know? So it's really, so think about it as part performance, part teaching system, part finding ways for when it's not working, what do you do? How do you manage? Yeah. How do you manage your own expectations? Because sometimes as teachers, we have too much, we expect too much of ourselves. And then we start to get frustrated. But if you start to get frustrated, then the energy starts getting funnier. In terms of practice, I have a lot of people who I talk with, because I'm not an official teacher, you know what I'm saying? It's like, but in terms of teaching practice, there are many people who I talk to about, you know, what works for them, what doesn't work for them, and, you know, analyzing workshops that worked for different types of people. You know, like I used to go into school sometimes, and then they would hire me to work with young black men who were failing. And then I work with these young black men, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. What's wrong is that they're not teaching them in a way they could understand. You know what I'm saying? Because as soon as they have that one-on-one information and you understand what they were lacking and you give it to them, they understand it completely. You know, but not everybody teaches in a way that everybody can understand, because they have so many different learning strategies and different types of neurodiversity. And you know what I'm saying? It's just like, whereas that's why, you know, I often think about the senses. I often think about rest. I often think about problem solving. I often think about independent rationale, independent reasoning. Because you can give them a template and then they can do it. But that's not necessarily just teaching. It's good. Yes, it's good. But if you can't send them away and they can't do it by themselves, the same thing you taught them, then they haven't learned.
Yep.
You know, so I think less about, in my teaching, about an end product, and then just like my creativity, and think nearly all about process. Because if a child or an adult enjoy the process, I can guarantee that they're going to leave the classroom and continue outside doing it because they enjoy the process. So how do I make that process enjoyable for them?
Mic drop. That's...
You're funny.
No, because... No, that is like printable, because it's... There's one... even the first point, thinking as a performer,
yes,
is something that is very familiar to me.
Yes,
but it's the first time that somebody openly says that's okay.
Okay, yeah, for sure.
You know, it's
these things go in and out of vogue too, depending on who you ask to, you know.
No, but it's from my person, I'm a professor at a well known and in my eyes and even in like in objective views, very good German art university.
Yes.
To my eyes, the best. And yes, this gives me kind of a heavy weight on my shoulders, because that's something to carry. So there's a history in my backpack that I have to keep up with in a way. And still, I know what I'm doing, and this kind of reading the room. As a student, I used to be a DJ, and I know how to read a room, how to run a room, and make a dance work. And
yes,
But I never thought about this as a key factor, as an expertise that makes me a good teacher in a way.
Oh gosh, amazing then. Yeah,
yeah, and it's like as you say it, I think yes, maybe this is basically the way I go into it, and then. The persons I don't get during my performance, I have methods to get them.
Yes.
Because I see, you're you're unattentive. You know, like, there's a squirrel in the garden and that's where your attention goes.
Yeah.
No stress. Here's a pen. Keep doodling all the time to keep your head running while I'm talking.
Or,
hey, easy, just 1 second. We just keep going, but 1 second of attention, and then you can go and do whatever you want. So this
sure.
kind of yeah, and I think that is that is something how to flow a course in a way, and that is something and also to that you emphasize the process so much is
it's so
clear for everybody, but still in not in our art school, but in many other departments of that I visited or people I talked to, it's always, it has to be, the whole thing, the whole course is judged by the end product. But what I learned is that the whole process gets lost when there is a product in the end. Everybody will still watch on this.
Everything
is the criteria is how is this. But
And
even to massage this knowledge into the students, hey, it's the process. Relax. Do you enjoy what you're doing? Does it feel right? So, and if it's in the end messed up, let's talk about why it's messed up and not why did that happen? Where in the process you took a different turn that leads you here? And the reflection of the process is much more important in the end than the result itself. I don't want to have the last words, Roger. It's up to
no, the last words were great. they were really, really great.
Cool, Roger. Thank you a lot for your time.
Thank you for talking with me, Christopher. I found it very interesting. You know what I'm saying? Good luck with all your teaching and your creativity and the creativity in your teaching.
Cool. Okay, so then I said thank you to all the listeners that made it till the end. Everything we talked about will be, not everything, but most everything will be in the show notes. For all the international listeners, thanks for your patience with the English. And then I say goodbye.
Hurra, hurra, ein Design-Podcast der Burg.